start, if I can have your attention. First of all, I want to thank you all for coming. I appreciate you coming out and supporting us. The Law Business Society has had a great semester and, well, great year, great semester, last semester as well. And I appreciate the support. I want to thank you for the support us along the way. One quick reminder, if you guys would turn off your cell phones, and I guess that's it. Also, one other housekeeping item. Mr. Green is going to be joining us for an afternoon informal Q&A talk at 2:30 in the Ray Room. So if you can make that, we'd love to have you. We'll go ahead and introduce Jay Green, our speaker today. He is the CEO and president of HealthSouth Corporation, one of the nation's largest healthcare companies. We're extremely excited to have Mr. Green with us. He, before going to HealthSouth in 2004, worked with HCA, Hospital Corporation of America, for a number of years, eight of which I believe you're president of the Eastern Division, is that correct? And before that, their predecessor, Columbia Healthcare. So, without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce, bring up Mr. Greeny. I appreciate you just welcome him with me. Thank you.
Great. Good afternoon. How's everybody today? You're probably wondering, why are you here when it's so beautiful outside, right? Thank goodness there's lunch and some incentive for you to be here. I would like to introduce one other gentleman who's here. Used to be the chairman of our board at HealthSouth, and probably the reason that I went to the company in the first place, and that's Joel Gordon. Joel, easily identified, one of the only few guys in the room with a tie on. Joel is just a phenomenal individual and really well respected in the healthcare industry. And so as we go through this presentation and you learn more and more about some of the challenges that we face at HealthSouth, and you may ask yourself, what was he thinking? You can thank Mr. Gordon for getting me to the company. We also have a large shareholder here, Mike Carr. Mike, you want to raise your hand? Has a daughter who is a Vanderbilt student and was in the area and thought he would stop by as well. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to have this be as interactive as you would like. I'm going to walk you through HealthSouth, what I saw when I got there back in May of 2004, some of the challenges that we faced, some of the actions that we've taken since then, and then open it up for any questions that you might have. I will tell you, this is one of the highlights of my job, is being able to come out to colleges and universities and to talk about not only HealthSouth, but business in general. And I know many of you are law students. I hope there are some business students here as well. But I think it's extremely important as you enter your careers that you understand that integrity, honesty, ethics, morality matter. I know when I was going through business school, we didn't have a lot of courses on that. I suspect that, with Enron and WorldCom and unfortunately HealthSouth, more and more classes on ethics are probably being introduced into curricula across the country. I sincerely hope so, because it is important, it does matter, not only in terms of sort of the larger picture of conducting our lives in an appropriate way. But it also matters, as you'll see in just a minute, from a shareholder standpoint. If you conduct yourself ethically, if you follow laws and regulations and comply with those, you're going to run a better company. And the shareholders ultimately are going to benefit from that. So with that, we're going to turn the lights down. A lot has been written about HealthSouth, and for those of you who don't know a lot about it, it was started back in 1985, actually in the middle of 84, by a gentleman by the name of Richard Scrushy. Ironically, it was founded basically to take advantage of a loophole in the Medicare reimbursement system, which when you think about it, it was sort of ironic that it was created to find a way around an existing regulation. But what happened was hospitals back in the 80s we're reimbursed by Medicare on a cost-plus basis. So it was pretty easy to run hospitals back then. If you spent $100 this year, you got reimbursed $100. There's no incentive to manage your cost. They put in place in 84 a system called the prospective payment system. And by that, we mean that Medicare started paying on a diagnosis-specific basis, and they would give you X number of dollars, and then if you were able to provide that care for less than X, you picked up the difference. You were able to keep that difference. If you had to provide that care and it cost you more than X, you lose. They're not going to give you any more than that specific DRG. The loophole was that in that regulation, they specifically excluded rehabilitation hospitals. They kept rehabilitation hospitals on a cost-plus basis. So Scrushy and some of the other founders saw that as an opportunity to get in, take advantage of that loophole, and begin a chain of rehabilitation hospitals. Now, the good news is, when they did that, they were able to attract and retain high-quality individuals, high-quality healthcare professionals and managers at the local level to develop really first-rate facilities and to establish HealthSouth as a leader in rehabilitative care. You can see then in the 90s, there was an explosion of acquisitions, mergers and acquisitions, fueled, we now know, in large part to hide the fraud that was being committed. The numbers weren't there, and so they went on this buying spree, and in so doing, they diversified the base of operations away from rehabilitation hospitals to include imaging centers, ambulatory surgery centers, and outpatient physical therapy centers. A lot of people have asked me, what were you thinking? Joel, of course, was very persuasive, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But clearly, in May of 2004, there were a lot of challenges that the company was facing. We had been delisted from the New York Stock Exchange. There were investigations, as you can see. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, was investigating the company. The CMS is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I'm not real sure why they don't call it CMMS, but CMS, that's the Medicare program. Of course, DOJ, all of you are familiar with that, Department of Justice. There was securities litigation against the company. There was derivative action taken on behalf of the company. In May of 2004, our bondholders were threatening to put us into bankruptcy if we did not pay them a consent fee to allow us to continue to be in technical default on some of our indenture. And the technical default was we weren't able to produce audited financial statements. And with that, they saw an opportunity. They came in. They said, you either pay us money or we're going to call the bonds, in which case we would have been unable to raise $3.5 billion at that point. So we ultimately ended up paying that consent. Morale was poor, as you can imagine. Physicians, who we were very dependent on for referring business to our facilities, were uneasy. They were scared. They were nervous. They were angry. Many of them left our facilities, stopped supporting us. On the horizon, we had this new Medicare regulation called the 75% rule, which was going to impact our largest division, the inpatient hospital division, which accounts for half of our revenue and 67% of our earnings. So it was a huge threat that was on the horizon. Nobody knew exactly what was going to the magnitude of this, but it was a significant challenge for the company. And then on top of it, we were highly leveraged. We had $3.5 billion of debt. And what the previous management had done is they had gone out and to help fuel and help fund a lot of those acquisitions that we saw occurring in the 90s, they went out and borrowed money. And they did that on inflated numbers. So they went out to the lending institutions and to the bond markets saying, we're a billion-dollar EBITDA, a year company. EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation. It's a surrogate for operating cash flow. We're a $1 billion a year EBITDA company. You ought to, you know, be willing to lend us more and more money. And at $1 billion EBITDA, $3.5 billion is reasonable. Problem is, we weren't $1 billion a year company. We were closer to $600 million a year EBITDA company. And as a result, the interest expense from this debt is significant. And ultimately, and we'll get to this in a minute, we're going to have to figure out how do we get around that, what do we need to do to de-lever the company. I think you know, anybody who takes on a challenge like this has to see the world a little different. Now, how differently? You know, people can judge if I'm crazy or if I just saw a great opportunity. I think it was a great opportunity because what I saw was a company with fabulous assets. At the local market level, where we provide the care and where the patients are treated, there was never any question about whether or not we were doing a good job. In fact, in many of our business segments, you'll see in a minute, we're either number one or number two. And the quality has never, ever, ever been assailed. So I saw that as a tremendous opportunity because that's where the business is. That's where the care is being provided. That's where the service is being provided. That's where the revenues are being generated. And I saw a real live company, even though others were thinking this company is going to go into bankruptcy. I saw great people. And if we don't have if we didn't have the quality of employees and managers, I probably wouldn't have been as excited. But it's reflected in the fact that, you know, we're providing high-quality care, and that doesn't happen just automatically. It's because of the quality of the individuals in those facilities providing that care. There was an enormous amount of upside from an operations standpoint. There was no standardization in the old health stock. Everybody basically did their own thing. There were, you know, antiquated information systems, no standard policies and procedures, no compliance program, no control over cash. And I saw that and said, hey, there's a great opportunity to come in, create this company along the lines of other Fortune 500 companies, put in those kind of disciplined systems and so on, and we will be able to generate, as a result, incremental value for the shareholders. I talked about the quality. There was already a strong compliance program, in large part thanks to Joel Gordon and the other members of the board, which was important to me. It signaled that they were extremely focused on that and that it mattered to them, and they weren't going to wait for the new CEO to put that in. They wanted to go ahead and get a head start on that. So I saw a tremendous company that really needed some strong leadership, new direction, and if we were successful in bringing those to the table, we'd be successful in turning the company around. So what I did is put together basically two plans. One was an immediate 100-day plan that was very focused, very intense, and then the second part of that was getting us through the most critical stage in the company's I think history, although the early stages back in 2003 was very critical. Nobody knew if this company was going to go into bankruptcy, and a lot of people credit Joel for standing firm and saying, no, this is a great company, we don't need to go into bankruptcy. So the shareholders, the employees, the bondholders, everybody owes Joel Gordon a lot of thanks for what he did back in 2003. The 100-day plan, I needed to first set the tone in the company, establish a new culture, extremely important. And you can see that what I did is I identified what those characteristics that I felt were important for the new health style: integrity, quality, compliance, a disciplined approach to what we do, execution on those plans, cost effectiveness, and then honest, open communication. On the first day, I had an all-employee meeting in our auditorium, and I was very pleased to see it was standing room only, so I think everybody showed up. Joel introduced me, I talked a little bit about my background, and then I laid out what I thought were the opportunities for the company and shared with them these characteristics, saying this is what I want this company to embrace and to the characteristics that I'd like this all of us to demonstrate in our lives. And at the end of the session, got a standing ovation. Now, I think that that really signaled to me, and I think to the other people there, that this company wanted change. They were open for that, and that they thirsted for a new set of leadership. We also identified some significant, what we refer to as rocks in the road. As I talked about before, we had a lot of litigation out there, a lot of potential legal threats to the company. And what we did is we said, hey, we can't get all of these done right away. So we're going to have to prioritize. What's mission critical? What could put us out of business? Let's get that taken care of and then move forward, which we did. I completely changed, and you'll see in a minute, the senior leadership of the company. And so one of my first orders of business was to bring in a senior management team, which I did. New chief operating and new chief operating officer, chief financial officer, and chief administrative officer. And then we went to, once that senior team was in place, we then went and replaced virtually all of the legacy senior executives of the company. It was real important for me to get out, do some tours, understand the markets, understand the facilities, talk to employees, talk to physicians, and learn more about the strengths and weaknesses of HealthSouth. The longer term plan then was to take that knowledge and to step back and say, do we need to be in all of these businesses? Do we need to have all of these facilities? Are some of them non-performing? Should we sell them or close them? And we began that process. The second thing was to establish a long-range strategic plan that would outline where this company needed to go over the next 3 to 5 years, and then to develop a supporting operational or tactical plan that would allow us to implement the strategic vision. We did that in collaboration with the board, started that in November, concluded that in April, got the board to approve it, and that is now the plan, which you'll see in just a minute summarized, that we're operating against. We needed to do something about the tremendous amount of debt that was burdening the company, the interest expense of almost $300 million a year. We had to figure out, how do we get out from that debt? And one of the biggest challenges that we had is that the debt that we had been created over a period of time, and so we had a very inconsistent set of indentures and bond covenants that were basically limiting our ability to operate. We also had very little bit ability to prepay any of that debt. In fact, about 93% of our debt used to be non-prepayable without a huge premium. So we were stuck. We were stuck without really being able to do much about that. We figured we got to get a plan together real quick to create a balance sheet that gives us more flexibility and more operational leeway. And then, of course, we had to put and convince everybody, hey, this is a new company. Had to do that with the investment community, needed to do with the business community, needed to do internally, and that was a big part of what I did in the first several months. So what is HealthSouth today? We're one of the largest diversified health services company in the United States. We have four business lines: inpatient rehabilitation, and the Stallworth Hospital here on the Vanderbilt campus is one of the hospitals that we co-own with Vanderbilt, and we manage that. And that's an example of the types of hospitals that we have, a rehabilitation hospital. And it's quite different than the Vanderbilt Medical Center or Baptist or Centennial. Those are general acute care hospitals where, you know, open heart surgery is done, orthopedic surgery is done, babies are delivered, there are emergency rooms, and a lot of diagnostic services that are performed. In our rehabilitation hospitals, we take the patients after their discharge from the Vanderbilt Medical Center, from the Baptist, from the Centennial, for those patients who need another 2 to 3 weeks of very intense rehabilitative or occupational therapy, we take those patients and provide that care on a post-acute basis. And we are the largest provider of rehabilitative care in the United States. As you can see, we're number one. We have about 22% of the national market share in terms of inpatient rehabilitative care.
We also are the largest provider of ambulatory surgery service. Surgery that's done on an outpatient basis. You present in the morning, you go in, you have your surgery. It's typically a pretty minor procedure, and then you're discharged in the afternoon and you recover at home. Joel Gordon was the founder and chairman and CEO of Surgical Care America, one of the companies that HealthSouth acquired and was a leading provider, was really the backbone of our ambulatory surgery division. We also offer outpatient rehab, which is physical therapy done on an outpatient basis. Many of our centers are small retail centers in strip shopping locations. And typically, we treat either workers' compensation patients or sports medicine injuries. Weekend warriors is what we refer to as. And then diagnostic imaging. The outpatient MRIs, the outpatient CAT scans, the outpatient ultrasound. Again, many of those centers are located in strip shopping centers or in retail retail environments. We have about 1,400, just under 1,400 facilities scattered throughout the United States. In 2005, we generated $3.2 billion in revenue, $629 million of EBITDA. We've got about 37,000 employees employed in those 1,300 sites. And you can see where our major markets are. I think we're in 47 states nationwide, but the market, that represents probably about 45% of our total, maybe a little bit more than that, of our total asset base located in those eight states. And now we're frozen. Ah, there it is. All right. In addition to creating a new direction for HealthSouth, it was extremely important that we create a brand new board of directors. The previous board had, at least some of the previous members of the previous board, really had too close a relationship with the former management, and we needed to change that out over time. You can see that with this new board, we have expertise in business, we have expertise in finance, we have expertise in sales and marketing, we have expertise in governance, we have expertise in healthcare. In fact, one of the board members is Dr. John Mothen, who is the president of Meharry Medical Center. I think probably you've heard that very, very tragically, one of his sons was killed early Thursday morning in a car accident. And so our hearts go out to Dr. Mothen and his wife Eileen. But he's a fabulous director, brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to our board. And you can see we've created a board with a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different expertise, and we're coming together, I think, quite nicely as a result of that. This is what the organization chart looked like in March of 2003. Everything collapsed at HealthSouth, the investigations, the raids on the corporate office on March 19th of that year. And this is what the organization chart looked like then. These are our, many people are still there. So you think about, and that is, if I were to take, and these are the top 25 individuals in the company. If I were to expand that to say the top 75, I would venture to say almost 90% of those are new people, new individuals. So think about the task of trying to fix something that was so broken, and at the same time, you're having to replace individuals along the way and put new leadership in as you're trying to put in new systems and so on. And so we've been able to get new management team, as I mentioned, a new chief operating officer, chief financial officer. One of the things I wanted to do was to make sure that we didn't just bring in healthcare expertise. So John Workman, who's our chief financial officer, was the chief financial officer for Montgomery Ward as they went through their restructuring. And so he brought a tremendous wealth of experience. He had a retail background that allowed us to tap into some of his ideas with respect to supply chain management and how to better manage on a dispersed operational platform. Jim Foxworthy, Chief Administrative Officer. All the division presidents are new. We put in new chief financial officers in all of the divisions and filled 9 new corporate senior vice president slots. We also, thankfully, have brand new financial statements. Now, this was a huge undertaking, probably the most complex restatement in corporate American history. You can see just some of the stats up there, just staggering. What we had to do is the company had previously submitted 10-Ks, which is the annual filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, for 2000 and 2001. They had never filed one for 2002. They were late. Everything hit the fan in March. It's about the time they were getting ready to file. They never filed. So we had to go in and we had to restate all of 2000, all of 2001, and then we had to create audited financial statements for 2002 and 2003. And we referred to that as our comprehensive 10-K. We did all of that and submitted that to the SEC in June of last year. To do that, we had to look at 1.4 million accounts, 92% of which had to be adjusted in some way. To do that, we invested over 1 million man hours. That's a staggering statistic. That's 500 man years devoted to cleaning up this mess that was created by the previous management team. Now, those of you who are attorneys or assume to be attorneys probably get kind of excited about this. We paid a lot of money to do that. Now, for those of you who are in the business school, take heart, most of that went to the accountants. But everybody got their fair share of the cleanup. And you can see 288 just for the in 2003 and 2004, another 170 million in 2005. We're going to be paying somewhere between $80 and $100 million in 2006. So you add that up, you know, that's almost $700 million. $700 million to clean up the mess from the previous management team. An enormous undertaking. That $700 million really should have gone to investing back in the business, investing back in the infrastructure, and developing this company. So when I said earlier, ethics matter, how you conduct yourself matters, this is a great example of why and how it really does matter, and there's tremendous consequences to the owners of the company, the shareholders, when things go awry. We completed our 2004 audited financial statements in December of 2005, and then for the first time since 2001, we are now a regular, timely, current filer with our audited financial statements when we submitted our 2005 10-K just a couple weeks ago. Huge undertaking. Took us about 18 months to get there, which is just phenomenal. I still can't believe that we were able to do that. But we are now on the road to being able to provide financial statements on a timely basis. We also have a brand new plan. I'm going to review that in just a minute, and then we'll open it up for some questions. First thing that we had to do is we had to streamline the portfolio. When I got there, we had over 1,500 individual facilities. And one of the hardest things that I had to do coming in was make the decision to close or divest probably 250 of those. It was a tough call. For those of you in business who ever get into this role, I hope you never take it lightly. The worst part of my job is when you have to make a decision to close a facility because you know that there are always going to be fallout employees who are going to lose their jobs. And yet, you know, that's one of my responsibilities is to make those tough calls so that the company can survive and ultimately the shareholders who own us will derive value from it. But I will tell you, when we do this, we always try to find a way to place those displaced employees. Great example,
We had a hospital there in Birmingham. It was a general acute care hospital. It was losing about $600,000 a month in EBITDA. And when I got there, I said, this makes no sense. It's one of three acute care hospitals. We're getting out of that business. We can't continue to run this. We need to shut it down. And there were three other hospitals in the general area that were getting most of the patients anyway. So we made the decision, but I said, we'll close it, but we ought to have as our goal to find jobs for at least 80% of those employees. If we can get 100%, that'd be great. Let's get at least 80%. And so we had job fairs. We first tried to find positions within Health South there in Birmingham. Then we opened it up for other healthcare providers to come in, and then we opened it up for non-healthcare providers. And at the end of the day, we placed 87% of those employees, found another job somewhere else. Now, I don't know if every company does that, but we do. If we ever close a facility, we go to great lengths to make sure that those employees who are displaced find a job somewhere else, either in our company, hopefully, or elsewhere. Because we realize that you know, those kinds of decisions have huge implications for people's lives, and we take that responsibility very seriously. We resolved the major rocks in the road. Talked about that a little while ago. We developed this strategic plan, and we refinanced our balance sheet. One of the most important parts about refinancing the balance sheet is the fact that we have now moved back a tremendous amount of debt that was coming due over the next several years. And this is a maturity schedule that shows that in 06, and it was actually in the third quarter, we would have to have refinanced $185 million, either paid it or refinanced it. The following year, $560 million. The following year, $660 million. The following year, $1.2 billion. And so we were looking at this and saying, holy cow, all we're going to be doing for the next 5 years is refinancing. And so we looked at this earlier actually it was late last year, and said, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to refinance the whole thing. We also looked at interest rates. Interest rates were starting to creep up at an all-time low. There's a tremendous amount of money in the market today. Credit markets are just as strong as I've ever seen them. Huge amounts of private equity money, huge amounts of borrowing capacity. And so we went ahead and refinanced it earlier this year. And by doing so, you can see we pushed all of those maturities out to 2011 and 2012. Now, there's some here where we just didn't, you know, they didn't tender the bonds, but it's a modest amount. We do have a bridge loan of $1 billion that will automatically renew, that we will probably replace with some high-yield bonds in the second quarter of 2006. And we're beginning that process. We'll probably get our 10Q, the first quarter SEC filings done, and then from that we'll go out and seek to issue some high-yield bonds. And then when we do that, this $1 billion will also be out there in 2012 or later. So what that does is it gives the company tremendous flexibility. We don't have to worry about our balance sheet. We don't have to worry about refinancing that in the short term. We're able to just focus on growing the business. This is a summary of our strategic plan. It was developed in collaboration with the board over a series of several months. I know it's a very complicated, kind of busy slide, but it was my way of trying to summarize what we needed to do over the next couple of years. We're halfway into this first phase right now, and what we're doing is we're focusing on improving the operations of our four business segments, standardizing our labor practices, standardizing our supply chain practices, improving our quality, focusing on sales and marketing. And by doing that, we will generate additional cash flow that will allow us to pay down some of that debt and then move into phase two, which is much more of a growth-oriented phase. And we're starting to prime that development pump as we speak. And that next phase will find us building new surgery centers,
building new inpatient rehabilitation hospitals, maybe acquiring individual facilities and bringing those facilities into our network. Ultimately, what we'll be doing is focusing on expanding our service lines to go beyond our traditional four service lines and move into other post-acute services like home health, home hospice, and if it makes sense, skilled nursing on a localized basis. And long-term care if the reimbursement on that ever improves. So I think you can appreciate in a very short period of time we've come a long way. So what are the lessons that we've learned as a consequence? Number one, oversight is extremely important. You cannot assume that the management team is going to do it right. You have to have strong oversight. In our case, it means having a strong board that is independent, where there are no conflicts of interest, there are no related party transactions. You look at the 10-K that we submitted, the comprehensive 10-K, there are pages after pages after pages of related party transactions. If you look at our 2005 10-K, we don't have any related party transactions, where there were deals between the directors and the company. Previous management, there are dozens of them, and we don't have any of that today. We have strong relationship with our external auditors. The internal audit function reports directly to the board. We have a tremendous focus on maintaining a strong internal control environment, which is mandated by Sarbanes-Oxley. Getting the right management team in place, obviously, it was important. And as you saw, we had to completely change out the entire senior management team at HealthSouth over the last 18 months. Having a clear direction, articulating what that is, being very clear and specific in setting goals, making sure that the culture is appropriate and that there's clear delineation of what those characteristics are going to be. Creating an operational platform that can be depended on and relied on, that uses the capabilities of the company to the fullest extent, and establishing priorities is probably the hardest thing. I mean, we've got a lot of people calling, emailing me, their suggestions, their idea. Everybody's an expert, and everybody has an opinion. And the hardest part for me, not the hardest part, because actually it's pretty easy, the hardest part for the company is to just say no and tune that out and say, okay, I'm going to get as much input as I can, but once we set that plan, we've got to execute on that plan. We can't be changing every 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months. Periodically, we'll assess, are we doing the right thing? We're doing that now. But, every 18 months or so is about right. Every 18 days is a bit frenetic, and it really doesn't make sense for the long term. And finally, as we launched into this, we realized, hey, we're not going to be perfect. Nobody's perfect. We're going to make some mistakes along the way. Hopefully, we'll learn from our mistakes. We'll course correct, and then we'll be able to adjust the direction accordingly. But we came in knowing that there was a lot of problems, a lot of challenges. We knew that we were going to be under the microscope. Everybody's going to be looking at us. But we said, if we go into this worried about being perfect, we're gonna find ourselves a gridlock. We will be too anxious to make any decisions. We won't be willing to take risks and get out there and make things happen. And I think that by being disciplined and by being comfortable that, hey, we're not going to make we are going to make some mistakes. We're not going to worry about that as long as they're not huge mistakes. And I don't think we've made any huge ones. I think that we've been very successful. So with that, I'd like to open it up for any questions that any of you might have. I hope that this has been somewhat informative for you. I think, all of you, be it in the law school or business school, this is the greatest time of your life. I've got kids who are students and or who have been students, and I keep saying, these 4 years of college and then the, 3-4 years of graduate school, and it doesn't get any better. It just doesn't get any better. Well, actually, maybe it gets a little bit better, but take advantage. I mean, these are just, terrific years. But what an exciting time for all of you. I mean, you're on the threshold of of creating and establishing your career and your profession. And you've got so many opportunities. I mean, Vanderbilt is such an outstanding school, and it's nationally recognized as being a leading quality institution. And I really hope that as you develop your plans and you launch your careers, that you'll take some of these lessons that I shared with you about the turnaround at HealthSouth, maybe be able to apply them in your situations. And I hope as a result, you'll find that you can look back and say, you know, I've had a great career, I've made a lot of improvements, I've added value to society. So that opened up for any questions that you might have.
How do you measure success? We're talking about reimaging in the financial community and the market as a whole. How do you gauge whether those efforts are being successful or not?
I don't know if you heard the question, how do you gauge whether or not we're successful in repositioning the company? Probably the most tangible evidence was the fact that we were able to refinance $3.5 billion with no current audited financial statements. That says something. You know, and the lending institutions, you know, aren't altruistic, you know, philanthropic, not-for-profit organizations who are just going to, you know, provide money just because someone asked. I mean, a lot of due diligence, a lot of focus, a lot of understanding, you know, what the direction is and so on. So I think that's one measure. Now, we are also launching, in fact, we selected a consultant firm to help us do this, to go out and to assess the general public's perception of the company. Because we have a pretty, I think, viable brand name. But I don't know if it matters. I mean, the previous management spent a lot of time marketing HealthSouth and putting that out there. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go out and do some market research across the country. And the first question we're going to ask is, does it matter to have a national brand in healthcare? My intuition tells me probably not, but I don't know. You know, here in Nashville, do you care? When you think about healthcare services, do you think about it from a national perspective that, you know, who's going to provide this? What big companies nationally? No, you think about Baptist, you think about Vanderbilt, you think about Centennial, and those are all local facilities. Now, they may be owned by a chain, but, you know, you identify more at the local level. But we want to ask that. And then we're going to ask physicians, patients, employees, you know, what kind of attributes does the HealthSouth name? And if they're good, that's great. If they're bad, are those bad attributes fixable? Can we improve that? And if the answer is yes, then we'll go down that road. If the answer is no, then we may look at changing the name. But I think that, you know, the fundamental way that we know that we're starting to reposition ourselves is the fact that we were able to refinance $3.5 billion worth of debt with no audited financial statements. Yes? You know, I don't know that, you know, you think back on something of this magnitude, and it's easy to say, how could someone not have known? I will tell you, from a management standpoint, I don't care what anybody in the previous management says, there's no way that previous management couldn't have known. But having said that, there was a lot of time and effort and creative thinking in how to keep this information from the board. Because the board isn't going to be looking at detailed, they're not going to be going through $1.4 million accounts. They're going to be looking at information on a quarterly basis. And what happened was the fraud was committed each quarter at the end of the quarter. There was the expectation for Wall Street were set, and they say, you know, they looked at the numbers, say, hey, we're not there, and then they found a way to fill in that gap. So the board, I mean, they were looking at financial statements that, you know, looked fairly reasonable. Where I think it fell down was the external auditors, and this is just my opinion, external auditors shouldered an enormous amount of responsibility because the board relies on that external, those external experts to dig deep on their behalf to try to see, is there anything going on that we should be concerned about? I mean, that the board can't do it. They have to rely on others. And they have to rely on management. And the fact that, you know, those, that reliance broke down at both of those levels, I think that that was a huge part of it. The fact that the external auditors didn't catch it, that's something that I cannot comprehend. And if you read some of the public information about the forensic studies that were done, and you learn about, you know, the attempts by the external auditors to get answers to questions that were rebuffed, but they didn't follow up. They didn't keep going. They didn't, you know, wave a flag and go to the board or go to the audit committee and say, hey, wait a minute, we're not getting this information. So the board really, I mean, I think that for the most part, they carried out their responsibilities. There were some individuals where it was so tied in with the related party. You know, I don't know what to really think about that. I don't think it's a good idea, frankly. But the cleanup has occurred really with a board that had some former members, the members that we felt were really contributing. Joel is an example of that. John Hanson was an example of that. Bob May, they were all part of that old board. So, you know, I think it's very unfair to say, well, you know, the old board was responsible. I don't think that they were. I think that they were, you know, they made decisions based on the information that was given them, and they relied on an external expert to provide them anything to the contrary, and that didn't happen. But the new board today, with the exception of John Hanson, everybody's new. And new since 2004. Yep.
On the 75% rule, how are you dealing, or HealthSouth dealing with that relative to the rest of the industry? And if you're doing better and you're looking to acquire, what kind of capacity do you really have to start acquisitions at this point?
Yeah, we're doing much better than the rest of the industry. The 75% rule, just quickly, is a regulation. It's a Medicare regulation that limits the kinds of patients that we can admit into our hospital, severely limits. The rest of the industry is down about 15%. Volumes, admissions into rehab hospitals for the entire industry is down about 15% year over year as a result of this regulation. HealthSouth volumes are down about 8.5%. So on a relative basis, we're doing much better. And our compliant case growth, in other words, the growth of those conditions that fall in those 13 categories, is actually growing at a very nice clip. Where we think, and we do have capacity for going out and acquiring. Our annual capital budget is about $150 million. About 70 of that is required just for maintenance. So we've got about $80 million out there that is available for acquisitions or consolidation. Where I think the biggest opportunity is, and what we're seeing occur, is in those markets where we have a presence, we're competing with a rehab unit that's inside the four walls of a general acute care hospital. They can't meet the 75% rule. They're struggling, and so we think there's an opportunity to go in there, either create a joint venture, no cash required, where we bring the two together and onto our operating platform, or we acquire that business, and many of those sellers would be not-for-profit hospitals. So what we're going to try to do is set up a method of paying them over time and basically allowing that acquisition to be paid out over time. We can fund that then through the incremental cash flow. Now, the rule goes up to 75%, and there's a stair step up. The current threshold is at 60%. That's being maintained for one additional year. Because there's an additional year at 60%, some of those potential sellers are
they still see it's a problem, but it's not a problem that they have to fix today. So it may slow down a little bit, but eventually I do believe that there's going to be a great consolidation play for the company.
Okay, one more question.
There, a number of healthcare providers over the last year and a half or so come under pressure for the difference in prices that are charged to insurance companies
yes.
versus the uninsured, and I was just kind of wondering how you thought that issue would have the possibility of changing the landscape in the healthcare industry.
Well, I think in the industry, it already has changed. You see big companies like HCA and even local community hospitals changing their policy for treating patients that don't have the ability to pay. And those policies basically are providing some kind of discount to those patients where those discounts didn't exist before. In the past, somebody came in, they had no insurance, they went into the emergency room, for whatever reason, they'd get a bill for $5,000. Or an insurance company, that might be $2,000. Well, the self-insured, they'd have to pay that balance. They'd have to pay the whole $5,000. Now, what usually happened, there'd be some counseling, and there would be some negotiation on saying, okay, how about you pay $4,000 over the next 5 years? But today, because of the new policies, patients who don't have any ability to pay are getting a much, much greater discount. And it's actually looking much closer to what the insured population is providing. Now, fortunately, in our case, it's really not that big of an issue because most of the patients that we see have some type of payment. Most of our patients in the hospital are Medicare patients. So our bad debt as a percent of total revenue is about 3%. If you look at the general acute care hospitals, it's closer to 13%. So it's a really big deal. And it's a big deal mainly because they have emergency rooms. That's where most of the no-pay or self-pay patients come, is through the emergency room. That's not a service that we provide, so we're not as hit. I think what it's going to do is it's going to put increasing focus on transparency in the healthcare system. And I think that that's good. For too long, we as providers have hidden behind the mumbo jumbo of medical jargon. We've hidden behind all of the very complicated reimbursement systems and charges that are don't have any bearing on the real cost of providing that care. And I think that over time that's going to be chipped away, and we're going to have to be much more transparent. It's going to have to be much more understandable. I'm sure that your generation, when you come up and you start accessing the delivery system, you're going to be demanding to know, how much is it going to cost? What's the quality? How do I know you're better than the guy down the street? My generation, it was the doctor said you got to go to this hospital, so you just go to that hospital. But today people are much more inquisitive. You've got all of these information sources out there on the internet that can provide some of that information. We're starting to see the Medicare program. Position quality as an important metric. If you provide better quality, you're going to get more money. And so slowly, the healthcare system is becoming more like other businesses in our economy. And I think that's in part one of the contributing factors is the fact that what you just said, there's a disparity in lack of transparency on the pricing. All right, we've got another session at 2:30. Happy to see any of you there.